SuperDoc 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bach, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. You can catch Crude Life Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on SuperTalk 1270. Joining us on the program, Jeff Kummer with, well, formerly Mineral Track. I remember when that popped up in North Dakota. Great asset, great tool for both landowners and the industry. But now with Meriden Carbon, Jeff, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey guys, really great to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
So I want to back up a little bit and just for the North Dakota reference, kind of talk a little bit about Mineral Tracker and the impetus behind that, because that's something that just, there was a need at the time, a big need. And you guys went out and got that established and filled a void that really existed for a long time between companies and landowners and mineral right owners and connected a lot of dots.
That's right. Mineral Tracker was just one of those projects that just made sense. I had seen success as a petroleum engineer working in the oil and gas industry for about a decade prior to launching Mineral Tracker with a good friend of mine, also a petroleum engineer, Joel Brown, in 2017, approximately. And the thesis behind Mineral Tracker was quite simple. It was, how do we build a tool that any landowner in North Dakota or wherever they might be can log in and understand a couple of things. One, were they getting paid correctly? And two, what was their asset worth? So we built decline curves for the entire basin and launched this tool that, you know, we thought a few people might benefit from, and turns out a lot of people desired that tool, and it got successful enough that a regional bank decided that it was more valuable to them than it was to us, and we sold that company right when COVID was rearing its ugly head in 1920.
Well, and the reason I want to go down this road, Jeff, is because, you know, the financial ramifications for Mineral Tracker were huge, because from a landowner's perspective, from a mineral right perspective, yeah, the question was always out there, are the dividends right? Am I getting paid the right royalties? Is everything working out the way it is? But the other side, on the front side, is those minerals are worth a lot of money, both from an investment perspective and a leverage perspective. So I understand why the banking side of things got involved with Mineral Tracker, because the ability, if you're a farmer or a rancher, producer, to be able to leverage that future holdings to work for you pays huge dividends in the ag side of things. So it was a really good fit.
I mean, it's an economic engine for North Dakota, right? And for so many places across the country. I tell you what, Steve, the biggest thing for myself and for Joel in launching Mineral Tracker, and it's also the impetus for this carbon business that I found myself in here more recently, is that the landowners deserve to be informed. The landowners deserve to be educated on their asset. Ultimately, the landowners deserve to have a seat at the table. And this is nothing against the oil and gas industry. The oil and gas industry, by and large, does an exceptional job when it comes to safety, when it comes to developing properties the right way. We just wanted to take that a step further with Mineral Tracker and say, hey, we're going to sit on the same side of the table as you and kind of go arm in arm to help you understand your asset that, you know, in many cases was generating incredible wealth and will generate incredible wealth for their family for generations to come. And so that's really, I think, the main part of the story and why we developed Mineral Tracker, is to give landowners more of a voice.
I think one of the, I guess, threads of the story before we get into the carbon business, Meriden Carbon, that you're launching now and that you're currently in doing in business with Mineral Tracker. I've been pretty critical on the state of North Dakota in the past couple years, But when I look at Mineral Tracker, I think that's an example of one where the state invested in a company that was an economic engine, and it did good for the landowners, and it did good for the industry. And you and Joel did very well in that as well. It launched you into new economic opportunities. How involved was the state in the process? At what point did you guys start working with the state on this? Because I know that they were involved a little bit.
Well, we like to lay claim that we were the first tech startup based in Watford City, North Dakota. So
there you
we'll
go. There
go
you
down
go.
In history,
yeah, put that on the tagline.
And ultimately, that's what it was. It was a grassroots startup with an idea from a napkin that translated into a web application. Is still going today under the banner of First International Bank. And Joel is still there working on the project. The state really got involved on this when we started talking with them about valuing all of the state's mineral interests, which, as you all know and the viewers know, is quite a large asset for the state of North Dakota. It generates a lot of revenue. And they asked us to come in and tell them what it was worth. And so we've been running, now Joel has been running kind of every year, every couple of years, major project to determine the value of that asset so that North Dakota can plan. That's where, to best my knowledge, where the state's been most involved in that project. And very helpful, by the way. And I think it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
How long did it take to, get things rolling? You said it started on a napkin. Before we go to break and get into the carbon business, which a lot of people are starting carbon businesses on napkins right now. You and I talked a little bit before we got on the air, and we called it the gold rush or the next .com, bubble type boom. And we don't know if it's going to be a gold rush that'll last 100 years or a dot-com boom that'll last, 3-4 years and then the bubble burst. But we both know the carbon industry is emerging and emerging fast. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But how quickly did you see back when you guys started that you knew, okay, this napkin is the real deal?
Yeah, great question. I think that I've been fortunate to be involved in several startups, and the common theme from those, almost all of those ventures, is that you don't usually end up where you think you're going to end up.
Right.
And so what started as a business plan from Joel and I saying, hey, we're two smart petroleum engineers that have worked in the industry. Let's set up a Main Street business with an open door and just answer people's questions and try to be helpful to them. Then translated into a web app, which we weren't planning on. And that really became the anchor of the business of Mineral Tracker. That process was, I think, a relatively short cycle time. You iterate on that, and that's 12 to 18 months. We were up and running and had a lot of customers and planned to, continue the business for a long time. And, as with other successful startups, the sign of a successful venture is when somebody else thinks it's more valuable than you do, and you move on. And so it was actually a fairly short cycle. But in North Dakota, there's so much money being generated and there's so much money being spent, and this might transition into the carbon business, is that these startup ventures follow the money. Where is the money being spent? Where is the money being generated? The billions and billions of dollars that have been spent in North Dakota and the billions of dollars that have been created for the landowners, both in North Dakota and wherever they might live, is it's incredible. And I think that when we look back 10 years from now on where we're at today in this carbon business, I think we're going to see that we kind of haven't seen anything yet. There's a lot of money going into this space. And it's going to be exciting to see how it all evolves. But, as an entrepreneur, you're just trying to provide solutions in an area that folks are putting a lot of money and a lot of investment into it. And that's super exciting.
We're talking with Jeff Kummer, formerly a mineral tracker, and now with Meriden Carbon. We'll get into the carbon side when we come back. I'm Steve Bach, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. You can catch Crude Life Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on Super Talk 1270.
The Crude Life would like to welcome and invite each and every one of you to the Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, February 7th and 8th, 2024. Oil, gas, wind, solar, uranium, Bitcoin, sustainable solutions, and much, much more at this year's Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, February 7th and 8th. Folks, you don't want to miss the Crude Life Podcast Pool Party happening February 7th. It's the week before the Super Bowl, folks. The Energy Exposition. The Crude Life is all in 2024. For more information, check out energyexposition.com.
Super Talk 1270. I'm Steve Bach, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. You can catch Crude Life Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on Super Talk 1270. And we're talking with Jeff Kummer, Meriden Carbon. And Jeff, let's talk a little bit about the carbon side of things. You know, you've been involved with many startups, getting things off the ground. Explain to listeners the role that Meriden Carbon has taken with everything that's going on in the carbon world. You're hearing carbon, 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 big onus put on carbon right now. Where does Meriden fit into that footprint?
Sure. The thesis for Meriden Carbon is very simple. Is that the world is short carbon storage. If the world wants to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide, so the first thing to know for your listeners is that when you hear carbon, that means carbon dioxide. Okay, CO2, that thing that all plants live off of, that thing that we exhale, that thing that is produced when fossil fuels are combusted, carbon dioxide. So when you hear carbon, it means carbon dioxide. And our thesis with Meriden Carbon is that the world is short carbon storage. What does that mean? That means that in order to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which has gone up in the last few hundred years, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up. That's true. If you want to reduce that amount and therefore reduce the effects of the greenhouse gas effect that contributing to global warming, and I'm not here to debate that. if you want to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you have to put it somewhere. You can't burn it. You can't, you know, put it in a box and ship it offshore. You can't shoot it into outer space. You have to put it somewhere. The only place to safely, permanently store carbon dioxide is deep underground, in rocks, in rock formations. And our thesis is that the world is short carbon storage. And that comes from the fact that the size of the perceived problem of carbon dioxide emissions is measured in the tens of billions of tons of CO2 per year, tens of billions of tons going into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels, whether it's your car, power plants, what have you, that is contributing to global warming, as some experts say. And if you want to not only reduce that, which means you're starting to capture CO2 from the source of the emission, think coal-fired power plants, think cement plants, anywhere CO2 is coming off of the smokestack, you can capture that. That's a technology that is, you know, somewhat nascent at scale, but it exists. And you can capture that and you can put it deep underground, or you're actually physically removing carbon dioxide that's already in the atmosphere through projects that some may have heard of called direct air capture projects, where they're physically eliminating CO2 from the atmosphere. However you're going to capture that carbon dioxide and reduce the amount that's in the atmosphere, you have to put it somewhere. And you have to put it deep underground. And the size of the asset that you need to make a meaningful impact on a tens of billions of tons of CO2 per year problem is massive. We're developing a project in Southeast Wyoming, arm in arm with landowners, which I hope to talk about here as well. It's something that I'm very passionate about, on 100,000 acres of land that we think may be able to sequester or hold 1 billion to 2 billion tons of CO2. And it may be the largest carbon storage asset onshore in the United States. So you kind of put those numbers together. The size of the problem is 30, 40 billion tons per year. And we have in development, perhaps one of the largest storage assets in the country that can do 1 or 2 billion tons per year. Therefore, kind of again, our thesis is that the world is short carbon storage.
I'm not sure if you can hear the trains in the background in my remote studio here, but I'm standing next to a empty, I've counted 75 cars, coal cars that are empty. They're going to Wyoming right now to pick up some coal and send it out across the nation here. Now, in North Dakota, we've got a couple different kinds of carbon. We've got ethanol carbon. We've got coal carbon, for example. In Wyoming, what type of project are you working on? What's the origin of the carbon, and how is it going to be transported? And so I imagine it'll just be pumped underground, correct?
That's correct. Yep.
As far as the terminus goes, it'll just be where is it going to be pumped underground, by the way?
About 2 miles underground into a sandstone formation that contains today saline water or salty water.
And how's that get transported? Is that through pipeline or on site? Like the Richardton Red Trail ethanol plant does it right on site. We have a Jared Walker coming in from Illinois to talk about on site ethanol carbon storage at the Carbon Conference. But then there's the, you know, Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline as well. And then of course you've got lignite energy, and you've got all these different types of transportation when it comes to carbon. How is it in Wyoming? And just kind of go over that a little bit if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. The first thing to understand is that you can't drill a well anywhere in the United States and put CO2 into the ground. Why? Because there's not a porous and permeable formation underfoot. The reason, the primary reason that CO2 is being transported from the Corn Belt to places like North Dakota and Illinois, and potentially even Wyoming via the Trailblazer conversion, is because the CO2 has to go to an area that has suitable geology. So in an ideal situation like Red Trail, they sit atop the Williston Basin. And so they sit atop a geologic situation that is conducive to injecting fluid into the ground the same way it's conducive to producing fluid out of the ground. And so, you know, kind of the simple fact for the viewers to understand is that the reason that you see CO2 being transported or being injected into the places that it is because the geology works. So in the state of Wyoming and Colorado and Illinois, North Dakota, Montana, all of those places that we know of historic oil and gas production, the reason there's historic oil and gas production is because they sit in a place that's geologically conducive to producing oil and gas. It exists and the geology is underfoot. So the ideal situation, like at Red Trail, is that they're sitting atop that. They don't have to transport. That's the perfect scenario. They're capturing the CO2 from the ethanol production. They're putting it in the ground on site. It's the least capitally intensive way to go about doing this. In the state of Wyoming, produces a lot of power from coal-fired power plants, from natural gas-fired power plants. And our business model is to be able to transport that CO2 from those power plants to our asset in Southeast Wyoming. Why is it in Southeast Wyoming? Well, there's a number of reasons. But again, you have to kind of consider the fact that you can't just plop a well anywhere. It has to be in the right place, which, you know, ultimately ties back to our thesis that we're short carbon storage, because it's a unique situation where you can unitize 100,000 acres of land, consolidate that, that doesn't include the federal government in our case, which is, in my opinion, a good thing. It doesn't have a lot of legacy oil and gas wellbores on the asset that could allow CO2 to escape from the formation that you're pumping it into. And last thing I would note is that the other reason that CO2 is pointed towards North Dakota and Wyoming is because they are two states that have primacy over Class 6 underground injection, which means that the state, an agency of the state, approves those permits versus those permits going through the gauntlet at the EPA.
We're talking with Jeff Comer with Meriden Carbon. When we come back from the break, Jeff, I want to talk a little bit about the, I'm going to ask you to put a couple different hats on at the same time, just for your opinion. And then we're going to get back into the carbon conversation. I'm Steve Bakken along with Jason Spies from the Crude Life. You can catch Crude Life Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on Super Talk 1270.
The Crude Life would like to welcome and invite each and every one of you to the Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, February 7th and 8th, 2024. Oil, gas, wind, solar, uranium, Bitcoin, sustainable solutions, and much, much more at this year's Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, February 7th and 8th. Folks, you don't want to miss the Crude Life Podcast Pool Party happening February 7th. It's the week before the Super Bowl, folks. The Energy Exposition, the Crude Life is all in 2024. For more information, check out energyexposition.com.
Super Talk 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bakken along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. Super Talk 1270. You can catch The Crude Life with Jason, the week in review. And we're talking with Jeff Comer, Meriden Carbon. And Jeff, your background, you know, you were one of the impetus of Mineral Tracker. And I want to marry the two for a second, because there's been a lot of conversations in North Dakota specifically about pore space. So from a mineral perspective, how does that fit into the perspective for the landowners when you're talking pore space and CO2 being injected as an asset or a royalty to those landowners from a mineral perspective? Do the two fit together?
They can. However, you have to differentiate between what formation you're putting the CO2 into. For decades, our country has pumped CO2 into hydrocarbon bearing formations for the purposes of enhanced oil recovery. This is done in a large way in southwestern North Dakota, eastern Montana, has been done for a very long time. In that case, where you're pumping CO2 in to help move more oil out of the formation via enhanced oil recovery, then you have an overlap between mineral ownership and the pore space those hydrocarbons live in. The business model of Meriden Carbon is to put the CO2 into formations that do not have hydrocarbons in them. Therefore, the CO2 goes into the ground and it stays there conceptually forever. In that case, that pore space is owned by the surface owner in the state of Wyoming and in the state of North Dakota. This varies by state, but focusing on those two states, the pore space is owned by that surface owner, the person that owns the surface of the land or the entity that owns the surface of the land. And there is not much for overlap, but naturally we have to think about drilling wells for the exploration of hydrocarbons and how that might impact penetration into a formation that is storing carbon dioxide. So that's getting a bit into the weeds. For places like in and around Bismarck, there isn't much for hydrocarbon production, and so you're dealing with permanent geologic storage via Class 6 injection, and that's an issue with the surface owner. That's who those companies would be dealing with.
So when it comes to getting started in the carbon business, how does one get started in the carbon business? Because you kind of have to go through the state, don't you, to get approved? You just can't go and, like you said, you just can't go drill a hole and start pumping it under there. New kind of wildcatting here in the carbon world, you know. Right. How does, you know, give us kind of the 101, because like we said earlier, this is kind of the new emerging market, and there's going to be a little bit of a mad, you know, that old world, mad, or that old movie, mad world or whatever it was. And, you know, just give us the 101. For me, I saw it coming. So, we partnered up with the Energy Exposition out of Wyoming. That's been around for 25 years to do the carbon conference, because I saw the future just like you. A couple of years ago, what was happening with this, and it's beyond global warming. Like you said, we don't want to get into that debate, because honestly, they don't really have anything to do with each other, to be honest. It's about being responsible with the environment at the end of the day. So how did you go about getting it started? Did you start with the state? Did you start with the oil companies? Did you start with, an ethanol plant? Just kind of, without getting into your business plan, just a little bit of an overview for those people licking their chops right now.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, to be completely honest with you, myself and a couple of others that I've worked with extensively in the oil and gas business kind of stumbled into this opportunity. We've worked assets in Wyoming for the past decade, which means that we've leased and drilled wells up there and ultimately sold those projects to bigger oil companies. One of those projects was in Southeast Wyoming, and we're a small company at that time. This is an oil and gas company. We're a small company, and like good small companies, you get to know the people that you're working with. And in our case, it was the ranchers of Southeast Wyoming. We were developing their asset for oil and gas production. And like I said before, it's always been a passion of mine with roots in Western North Dakota. Been blessed for a lot of reasons because that's where God placed me. One of those is just having an affinity for the landowner. That's what led to Mineral Tracker. And I think ultimately that's been part of the impetus for Meriden Carbon. And in getting to know the ranchers out there, they approached me a couple of years ago, 18 months ago, and said, "Hey, what do you know, Jeff, what do you know about pore space?" And I said, "Probably more than the average Joe, but let me do a little bit of research." And that's what led to the development ultimately of Meriden Carbon and a simple business model, frankly, working arm in arm with the landowners to put together a large enough block of land that could make a sizable impact on how much CO2 you could put into the ground. That's kind of where we're at now with the business. It's not super complicated, but I do think it is novel in the way that we're approaching this. Ultimately, this CO2 is going to be stored on this land that has been in some of these families, some of these ranchers' families for over 100 years. And this can't be a fly-by-night type of operation. It needs to be done correctly. And I think, in my humble opinion, it needs to be done sitting on the same side of the table as these landowners, which I do think is a novel concept. And from here, we are going to seek some support from state and federal funds. There's plenty of those that are out there to develop these types of projects. Ultimately, this is not a venture that this is different from oil and gas in the sense that, in my opinion, this isn't the type of venture where you pump tens of millions of dollars into something via private equity or otherwise, because we don't know what the return looks like. It's very complicated, right? The return is coming from the federal government because the federal government is stimulating this type of project. So the way that we're approaching this, not laying out incredible amounts of capital up front, in fact, writing the checks ourselves, to just see where this goes and go through a very rigorous permitting process that will take us a couple of years to get a well ready to inject carbon dioxide. And in the meantime, our hope is to build a pipeline or two to connect some of these coal-fired plants around the region and start making a dent in the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere.
We're talking with Jeff Kummer of Meriden Carbon. When we come back from the break, more with Jeff. I'm Steve Bach, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
The Crude Life would like to welcome and invite each and every one of you to the Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, February 7th and 8th, 2024. Oil, gas, wind, solar, uranium, Bitcoin, sustainable solutions, and much, much more at this year's Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, February 7th and 8th. Folks, you don't want to miss the Crude Life Podcast Pool Party happening February 7th. It's the week before the Super Bowl, folks. The Energy Exposition, the Crude Life is all in 2024. For more information, check out energyexposition.com.
SuperDoc 1270, you're tuned to Talk of the Town. I'm Steve Bach, along with my co-host, Jason Spies. You can catch us from on The Crude Life, Sunday mornings, 10 a.m., right here on SuperDoc 1270.
I'm in coal country, baby.
Just one of the many, many ventures that you're in. ESG University, of course, a lot of other stuff. We're talking with Jeff Kummer, formerly of Mineral Tracker. You might know him best from North Dakota in that regard. But Meriden Carbon, which is working a lot of space in Wyoming, and you had a follow-up question, Jason. I want to let you get to that before we wrap up with Jeff.
I did, because, you know, one of the things when we're doing the Carbon Conference and the Energy Expo, it was in Wyoming for like 25 years, and it was open mm-hmm. to the public and that kind of thing. And so when I'm hearing about, you know, the federal dollars and the state dollars and the, you know, taxes that are going into the carbon industry, as Jeff said earlier, you know, the government is stimulating this. This is being pushed by the government. So if I'm a taxpayer and I'm hearing this, I kind of want to know what my money's going to. What's going on here? What's all this stuff? So, Jeff, I don't know if you have ever answered this question or not, but if somebody's listening out there and they don't have anything to do with oil and gas, nothing to do with energy, they just, you know, they work whatever job and they pay their taxes. What can they expect out of this? Because there's a lot of money really being pumped into this from the government, and they're stimulating it, like you said.
Yeah. Like it or not, we're in the middle of an energy transition. My background and so many blessings financially in my life have come from the oil and gas industry. I'm super thankful for that. But we're in the midst of an energy transition. And this energy transition, what I mean by that is going from fossil fuel-based economy to something else, whether that be hydrogen or other types of renewables, nuclear, these types of things. And for the sole reason that the combustion of fossil fuels, a byproduct, is carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas and is said to contribute to global warming. This transition is going to take decades, and it needs to take decades, because as you mentioned, those rail cars headed back to Wyoming to load up with coal, they need to keep doing that for quite a long time, maybe for the rest of our, you know, careers, our lives, because it's a quality of life thing. Fossil fuel energy production needs to be a part of the equation. It's a major part of the equation today. It will continue to be a major part of the equation for years and probably decades into the future. But you have to understand that, again, like it or not, we're in the middle of a transition. Your kids, grandkids, or grandkids will, you know, think back to the oil and gas go-go days as something that, you know, is history.
Well, that's already being planted, Jeff. Have you seen the new Jim Gaffigan special?
No, I haven't.
Oh, part of his thing is where he's like going, yeah, we're going to, our grandkids are going to look up to us and say, did you believe in global warming? How come you didn't do anything about it? He's already trolling us by our grandkids. You know, I mean, so it's
so the the global powers to be have kind of, this is a foregone conclusion, right? This is the way that they're headed. And the way to get us there, again, I'm not here to debate whether that's right or wrong. I'm just telling you that's what's happening. And as a capital, as a capitalist and as an entrepreneur, we're placing ourselves in a position that I think is a good one. I think that you know, the world is going to wake up to the fact that what the heck are we going to do with all of this CO2? And it's going to be assets like we're developing with Meriden Carbon. And we hope to develop many more with these arm in arm with landowners across the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains. That's where we're at. So.
I think you're going to find new uses for it too, because I've said this for a long time with the coal industry, that I think coal needs to be reinvented, meaning that maybe it can be activated and then all of a sudden we can use it to filtrate our water and it solves our fresh water problem. And then all of a sudden coal goes from being demonized to being idolized once again. And I think carbon is going to go down that road too. And so I was against the big crash course, the, you know, $17 trillion that whatever is being invested into climate change, because, you know, the atmosphere is heating up, but I just didn't agree with the crash course and the rush and everything. But now that it's done and it's happening, what point does it do to argue it anymore? Now it's how can we get in front of it and make it responsible and make it environmental, so that the bad stewards don't end up taking it over, so that the good stewards can come in. And like you said, the entrepreneurs and some of the people who know how to fix the problems can actually take that money and do some good things with it. That's how I'm looking at the carbon market now, because I was a very much against not climate change, but just the mad rush and the timetables that they were putting on this. Cause I don't know, I still believe the sun directs it all and I'm a crazy man because of it. But I believe sun and land use are your number one and number two drivers of carbon. But anyway, Steve, sorry, I'm just rambling now. I'm getting on my soapbox. I got to get down for my coal cart here. Okay.
don't fall.
You've hit the nail on the head though, that you can't swing the pendulum so far the other way that ultimately people die, right? When we shut off the way that energy is produced in this country and globally, you shut that off too fast and it's catastrophic consequences. We need fossil fuels to be in the mix for energy production. But I think we also need smart entrepreneurs, business people, political leaders that are saying, all right, let's do this responsibly. Let's do this the right way. Let's take the long view on this. Mm-hmm. And then we get to where we ultimately need to get to.
All energy has a purpose and we are all energy, you know, and that's really the way that I look at a lot of life, because you and I are energy. Coal is energy. Carbon is energy. It's all there. And so how we go about it responsibly, how we do it ethically, and how we do it together is really, I see where the future is at. Steve, I know we got a little kumbaya coal on you, but that's okay.
I love coal. Hey, Jeff, we're up against a break, but I do have one more question. Who's your customer? Because I know in North Dakota and Iowa and South Dakota, and they're looking at ethanol. When you're in Wyoming, who's your customer? What are you looking at, and how do you get that product to where it needs to be sequestered?
The customer for us is primarily the utilities. So those that own the power plants, think Basin Electric, Black Hills, these types of players that, you know, are in the middle of their own, you know, planning for strategic planning for how they're going to make clean coal, ultimately capture the CO2. And, you know, there's coal-fired power plants speckled all over. We think of ourselves like a hub with spokes out to these different plants, whether it be in Western Nebraska and in Wyoming, maybe even up into South Dakota. The CO2 will be transported via pipeline. That's the only reasonable way or commercially viable way to transport the CO2 is under pressure as a liquid via pipeline. And heck, perhaps We even see some of the CO2 coming from those ethanol plants from the Corn Belt, also Kansas and Iowa and other places that so much planning has been done for transporting that CO2 from ethanol facilities. Southeast Wyoming is about as close as the Illinois and North Dakota pass that they're considering now, and keep an eye on a Tallgrass Trailblazer pipeline. This is a natural gas pipeline that runs from Wyoming into Nebraska, Southeast Nebraska. That's being converted to transport CO2 back out to Wyoming. That's a Tallgrass project. So there's a lot of things at foot here. Ultimately, that CO2 needs to find the right home in the right geologic setting, in the right state, with the right landowner mix. And I think that's what we have with Meriden Carbon. And we're hoping to be able to multiply this, do this right once, and work with landowners and utilities and others to develop these assets, you know, maybe up and down the Rockies and into the Great Plains.
Jeff, if anybody's got any questions or wants to get a hold of Meriden Carbon, how did they do so?
Yeah, you can find us on our website, meridencarbon.com, M-E-R-I-D-E-N, carbon.com, or even just shoot me an email, jeff@meridencarbon.com. Love to talk to you.
Jeff Kummer with Meriden Carbon. This has been Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
The Crude Life would like to welcome and invite each and every one of you to the Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, February 7th and 8th, 2024. Oil, gas, wind, solar, uranium, Bitcoin, sustainable solutions, and much, much more at this year's Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, February 7th and 8th. Folks, you don't want to miss the Crude Life Podcast Pool Party happening February 7th. It's the week before the Super Bowl, folks. The Energy Exposition. The Crude Life is all in 2024. For more information, check out energyexposition.com.